It's quite an honor for me to be invited to speak to you all like this. When Jim first mentioned the talk to me, my first thought was I could probably sum this up in about 5 minutes and we could be out. And then I started writing an outline and I started running into the opposite problem, so hopefully I can find balance in this talk. I do think it's important to make sure that anybody here who has not been to a way-seeking mind talk, if there is anyone, I'm not sure, but to clearly define what this is and what I am not. And that's not, I'm not a teacher, I'm just a practitioner, a student here like anyone else. And as Dora Lee mentioned earlier, that this is really about, you know, how I came to be here. I'm not sure how to do that other than to just go chronological and give my life story, which is not something I'm used to doing. So I appreciate, everyone's attention and patience. When I was working on, what I was going to talk about, I, like anyone, started Googling way-seeking mind, and the first thing that comes up, at least on my computer, was a brief talk that Sojourn Mel Weissman Roshi gave maybe, 30 years ago. And the first thing he said in it was defining way-seeking mind as a deep intention to align oneself with a true path. Suzuki Roshi used to call it our inmost request. We say get rid of desire, but we can't really get rid of desire. When desire is in conformity with our deepest request, then it's no longer called desire. It's called way-seeking mind. So I'm still questioning what my inmost request is, but I think maybe this helps me get there, if nothing else. So as many of you know, I'm not from here. I grew up on Long Island, New York, a land of bagels and pizza and lots of stereotypes that are mostly true about Long Island, New York, but also a beautiful place. I have four siblings, and the funny thing about my family is there's about an 18-year span between my oldest brother and my younger sister. And despite that, we are all very, very close. I will quickly mortify my mother, who I believe is watching, from the same house that I grew up in. So hi, Mom. We're, I guess, what you would call a very traditional Irish Catholic family. We went to church every Sunday. I went to Catholic schools all the way from kindergarten through college. And despite, the connotations that come up, that may bring up, I actually had a very positive experience in those schools. I was lucky that the priests and the nuns and the brothers in most of those schools were actually of the variety of Catholics that were really kind and preached, loving your neighbor and study, and I did not necessarily grow up with the brand of Catholicism that gets a bad name these days, so I'm grateful for that. I did grow up with the brand of Catholicism because it is with the good old Catholic guilt, and I can remember this funny memory, and I'm sharing it because it kind of relates to our practice here. We were taught to pray every night, to say your prayers before you go to bed, and that started with reciting, the Our Father, the Hail Mary, the standards of the catalog, and then you would say God bless, and it'd be God bless, my parents, God bless my family, God bless my friends, God bless. And for me, I had to keep going. I always felt really guilty if I stopped before I got to God bless everyone I know, everyone I don't know, all the animals, Everything in the universe, nothing, everything I'm thinking of, God bless God. And, you know, it's funny now looking back with a different lens, it's almost like a meta loving kindness meditation that I was doing as a kid, and I don't think that makes me special. I think that's just what kids do. But, you know, it also makes me think of our Bodhisattva path, so perhaps there was hints of that early on. When I was 14, I found what I'd consider my first real love, and that was music and playing guitar. I started taking guitar lessons. You know, that would be something that I, you know, continues to this day. And I'll get into how that, you know, really shapes my life. But yeah, I also around that time going to high school. The second love, and this is more of a love-hate, but I became a distance runner in high school, and I was following in the literal footsteps of my next oldest brother, who was also a distance runner at the same school, to the point where one of his teammates ended up being my coaches. But running, you know, became very central pretty quickly, and I got, you know, pretty good at it in a way that I wasn't at other things, other sports especially. To the point that by the time I was a junior and senior in high school, I was recruited to run in college. And so I decided to, I had this feeling that, you know, it was really important for me just to figure out how good I could get. Like, I just wanted, how good could I be? So I'm going to go to the place where I'm not very good on the team, because that'll make me better, as opposed to going somewhere where I'd be kind of one of the top people. So I ended up at Villanova University in Pennsylvania, and Villanova has a very storied running program. They, my coach at the time, who's still there, he had just started when I, you know, a year or two before, was by the name of Marcus O'Sullivan, and he was this famous Irish runner, Olympian, and so I was like, I'm going to go run with this guy, and he's going to, you know, get the best out of me. So that's what I did. I went off to college, and you know, it was really competitive. It was, and I mostly liked that. At least I thought I did. And you know, at that point, it became the focus of my life. Like, school took a not a backseat, but it was definitely second to training and competing, and that kind of drove everything for, you know, my college years. Meanwhile, I would still go to mass some Sundays. I started, you know, not going, experimenting with loosening my grip when I was on my own. But the one thing I always found refuge in was an empty church. And I would, you know, being a Catholic school, there's a big, big church right in the center of campus, this gorgeous building. And I would go in it, and just sit when I needed to, when no one was there, when it was quiet. And that was my favorite thing to do in that church. My college years is also getting back to the music, is when I started songwriting for the first time. And I was probably or definitely overconfident in my abilities. I thought I was going to be, you know, I mean, I don't want to say the next Bob Dylan, but like I thought I was going to be something. But bottom line is, I knew, like, this is it. This is what I want to do. Which is a really fantastic thing to figure out when you're in your 20s and you're trying to figure out your career path, is to go down this path that leads to nowhere usually. But but it gave me direction. And I started doing like campus open mics, and I started playing my own coffee house shows. And the thing I noticed was, you know, I would get nervous beforehand, but the nerves were very different flavor than they were before I was when I would, you know, be about to race for my team. The nerves for playing in front of people was like kind of exhilarating and something that I just felt I had to do, and the nerves of racing were so overwhelming that I can only look back now and be like, oh, that was anxiety, and I had no idea what it was. So that was, you know, my college experience. But then by senior year, I kind of fell into a, I guess you'd call it a depression. My running career at that point, I knew I was at the point where, I wasn't going to be able to run, professionally because only a couple people can do that. And I knew this was really my last chance to prove myself and to like be as good as I thought I could be and like kind of show everybody else. And so I started training really, really hard. I was running 90 to 100 miles a week. And fitness, like I was in the best shape of my life. I was ready. And every time I got into a race, this weird thing happened where the beginning of the race would be this amazing feeling like, this is it. This is the one. This is the breakthrough race. And then the next thing I knew, it would feel like I had already was at the end of the race, but I had the whole race ahead of me. So in other words, like my body would just give out. And I thought it was a one-time thing, and one time he gains two, and the only race I ever had to drop out of was the NCAA championships my senior year. And we were trying iron supplements because maybe it was that, or we were trying just different things. But since that time there's been a lot of information has come out on kind of oh, I forget what it there's an acronym called REDS, and I completely forget what it stands for, but essentially it's overtraining, and I'm pretty sure that's what was going on, where I could be in good shape, but just the tank would completely drop, and I was running slower than I ever had in college when I was supposed to be in the best shape of my life. All that to say that that just continued all year, and it left me in a dark place by the end of the year where I just wanted to get out of there. I remember being at graduation and just feeling so out of place and unable to talk to anyone really about it because I didn't know what it was. And I kind of blamed myself, I guess, for it. And what it really was, I was, obviously disappointed. I was obviously, invested, what felt like my entire life to a 21, 22-year-old. But I was also embarrassed. I realized how much I was trying to prove to, my friends and my teammates, and the competitiveness there puts up some walls, for some people that, you're not able to talk about these things. So by the time I left, I, was like, well, I guess I'm done. I'm done with running. But now, like, I'm going to focus on music. I'm going to be a, singer-songwriter. And so I moved back to my parents' house on Long Island, and I was working in like running stores, selling running shoes and specialty shops like that. And our family business of home heating and cooling. And but I turned my childhood bedroom into a makeshift recording studio and started recording music. So that I would have a CD that I could put out, which I learned how to be, essentially your own record label, so that I could send that to places to try to book shows, because that's how you did it back then. This was like 2004, so it was before Spotify and all the streaming stuff. Email was like the big advance. You didn't have to mail people packets of things. So the first real show I did, like the first thing I booked in New York, this was going to be my big thing. There's a place in New York, maybe you've heard of, called CBGB's, and I didn't play at CBGB's. I played at CBGB's bought next door and called it the CBGB Gallery, which was for small singer-songwriters, because if you know CBGB's is like a dirty punk indie rock, like in-your-face place, and I was just a young guy with a guitar playing, I guess, what would you call Americana folk music. So anyway, but I got this show. I told them I could bring, the 10 or 15 people. I made my family and friends come into the city with me, and they were the crowd, which is what they don't tell you when you want to be a singer-songwriter, musician, that's usually what your crowd is. And that's what I did for a while, for about a year or two after college. And then, meanwhile, my brother, he lived in Boston. He's also a musician, but he was a high school science teacher at the time. But he had found an ad or something for this improv comedy theater that was hiring musicians to be like music directors for different casts. And he's like, he was really like into this and wanted to try it out. So he went and auditioned and got it. So I went up that summer to go see this thing he was doing. And it was really, you know, it was fun. It was cool. And then like we went to a bar afterwards around the corner where all this like comedy people hung out in Boston. And we started talking to other people from this theater he was involved in. And I started talking to this, you know, young woman about my age, and you know, she seemed cool. She was easy to talk to. We were getting along, but you know, I went back to New York living with my parents, and she, you know, was on this main stage of this theater. And but theater people being what they are, somebody called me and was like, you know, she likes you. Okay, so I think you know, maybe a month or two later, it was her birthday, and I sent her flowers and had them delivered to work, which is a risky maneuver. You know, we started talking on the phone, talking every night for these marathon conversations. Long story short, because I have a lot to get through, 6 months later, I moved up to Boston. My brother and I got a place that was two doors down from my now girlfriend, Taylor. And, you know, we all kind of, our life revolved around this comedy theater for 2 years that they both worked at. I also, in Boston, I was writing more songs. I worked with a friend who owned a recording studio, and we made a record there. I started a band to help me play those songs, and we were playing all over Boston, which had at that time a, you know, pretty burgeoning Americana scene that was fun to be part of. But I was only there for about 2.5-3 years. But during that time, Taylor and I got engaged. And we were going to be married at her parents' house in their backyard in Ohio, where she grew up. So we get married. And then the big decision we had, because we had decided to leave Boston, and she was pursuing acting, I was, you know, pursuing music, both working, you know, whatever jobs we could. We were between, you know, should we move to Los Angeles? Should we move to New York? And only that way that like 20-something-year-olds can just be like, let's just up and move across the country, or not. LA won out because she moved out there first. Her brother was there, and she made some, you know, early headway. So we ended up getting married in 2008 and then going on a honeymoon and coming back to Ohio and driving from there to LA. LA, I went there not knowing much about LA, and a lot of people have a lot of opinions about LA, but I will stand up for it forever because I had an amazing time there. Mostly because we lived real close to the ocean. This is a time when you could still get like relatively cheap rent-controlled apartments in Santa Monica, maybe a mile from like the beach. So my day was walking. My job was in Santa Monica. I worked at a nonprofit. This is the beginning of my nonprofit career, which I'll also get to, that was housed in a hostel because the nonprofit was about hosteling and travel and youth culture and things like that. So I'd ride my bike to work. I, you know, was living in Sunshine. All these people were complaining about how hard it was to be an actor. And I was like, great, good for you. Like, I'm going to play music. And that's what I did. I played music. I started this songwriter series there in the hostel. They had this really old room that had awesome acoustics, and they were looking for programming. So I said, let me, you know, run a songwriter circle. And I started booking people and met my closest friends in L.A. by inviting them to come play, and we'd sit around, and even if no one showed up, we'd get to like just play music, and it was fun. So also during that time, the theme of my talk could also be kind of tangents and sporadic aspirations, but I also was really interested in writing, fiction writing, and I was, I'd always been a big reader, and it was always something in the back of my head that I thought I would do someday, but I could only focus on this music thing. That's enough heartache and hard stuff to do. But it really started coming up for me more and more, and I had this idea that I just needed it to be structured. So I thought maybe I took some classes at UCLA on fiction writing, and when you start going down that road, pretty soon people start talking about MFA programs, graduate programs, master's programs in writing, because that's a whole crazy world unto itself. But I decided, like, well, I'm gonna apply and see what happens. And we thought we were getting tired of LA. Maybe we should, see what happens and move. Taylor and I, early in our marriage, we felt like we had to just up and move every 3 years for some reason, and it's probably why we've never saved money. So anyway, I was applying to these MFA programs, and I got into one, and it happened to be a place called Stony Brook University. And Stony Brook University is about a 5 to 10 minute drive from where my mother is sitting right now. It's like the next town over from where I grew up. So ironically, I get into the school that's, back where I grew up. And they had kind of a New York City satellite campus that I could take most of my classes at. So we decided to go for it. We up and moved to Brooklyn in 2011. And I spent, 2.5, 3 years writing. I wrote a novel as my thesis. I taught a fiction class to undergrads. I got to work on like all these student films because I was a graduate assistant, and the person I worked for was launching a film program. So I kind of got all this weird experience doing all that type of stuff. And I worked at the school as my job, so my days were pretty unstructured. I got to like wake up late and write, and then go do some work. It's also in New York. I didn't do it in New York. I did it in Philly. But during this time, it was the only time I ran a marathon, my one and only marathon that I trained for in the midst of all this. So anyway, that's kind of all a preamble to moving here to Sacramento. After I finished grad school, a funny thing happened in New York where Taylor and I really, we put off having a family. And the idea of like trying to even attempting to have a kid in New York was just seemed impossible. We lived in a tiny, tiny apartment. It just seemed like we couldn't do it. Everything was so expensive. All we heard was stories about how much you had to pay for school and all this stuff. So it started feeling like the walls of New York City were kind of closing in on us. And we also just really missed California after living in LA so much. And lucky for us, meanwhile, during this time, Taylor's parents ended up moving from Ohio to the Sacramento area for my father-in-law's job. And so we thought, there's a home base to start from. We'll move back to California, but it'll be Northern California. We visited them a bunch and actually really liked it here and thought it was beautiful, so let's give it a shot. So we moved in August of 2014, and a year later, 2015 August, almost to the day, my daughter was born, my daughter Finola. So that, is probably the biggest turning point in my life, not surprisingly as a parent, but I immediately loved being her dad. I have this experience or this memory, the night she was born. Being in the hospital, and the nurse had just showed us kind of how to swaddle the baby, and I'm holding this little newborn that's, not even the full length of my forearm, like this, just staring at her face, these blue eyes looking up at me. And, I was already delirious from lack of sleep, but this experience of kind of like time melting, I can't describe it, but it felt like I was looking at like myself as a baby and this fully formed human that was completely their own person at the same time. And I just, you know, like it was undescribable. So obviously that was amazing, but as much as I love and loved becoming a father, and my daughter's this human who is so full of empathy and kindness and silliness. She's 10 now, if you didn't do the math. But I also, becoming a parent gave me anxiety like I had never known immediately. Like, I was so panicked on being in charge, of being in control of, I guess, of this person's life. And at the same time, Taylor, my wife, was going through some pretty severe postpartum depression, you know, for like a year or two after Finola was born. I had this, you know, not great memory, though, of, you know, one of those first nights being up real late and realizing how much everybody needed me and telling myself, you know, I was panicking, but telling myself, there's no room for your emotions here. There just isn't. There's nothing you can do. And obviously, that's not a good thing to tell yourself, and it's going to come back to bite you later, and it did. And I will get to that. But so anxiety became a kind of fixture for me after that. I was maybe 2 years or so, a year and a half after Finola was born, when things started calming down a bit, because that's a, you know, just a wonderful age where kids start becoming self-sufficient and their own people. And, you know, I could let go a little bit. And by letting go a little bit, it kind of all came out. And so that's when I knew this was bigger than just like a passing thing. You know, it led me to a therapist. It led me to fighting insurance companies to get therapy. It also, I had been what I would say informally meditating for years at this point, very sporadically, like all through LA, New York. I would randomly, I don't know where it came from. It must have been, like, I did a little bit of yoga. It must have come from that, but I would sometimes just start sitting and with no instruction, just be like, oh, this is what people do. Or maybe they do this. Or maybe they do this. And I would just kind of sit there. And, like, it felt really natural, though, to me to do that. And so I'd go through periods where that would become more or less important. But during this time of anxiety, I discovered this app on my phone called Headspace. And I was really reluctant to try it because I thought my phone was a big reason why I was having these struggles. So why would I use my phone to try to get, you know, to help with that? But I did it, and I ended up, you know, meditating for 100 days straight in a very haphazard way. You know, it would be 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, like, oh, I didn't meditate today. Like, it was something I had to check off. So I would, okay, got to do it. And I'd be falling asleep on the chair doing it. I'd maybe have had a couple of drinks, and I would be falling asleep meditating. Not the way we learned to do it, but I kind of, like, crashed through that. And it really helped, not in the way that I wanted it to, but in the way I needed it to. It wasn't an immediate fix, but it started teaching me about creating space. And lo and behold, I found out that all of these things that were being snuck into these meditations were Buddhist concepts stripped of any Buddhist language, because the person who started this had been a Buddhist monk, I think, in maybe a Tibetan tradition or a Thai tradition, and was, you know, trying to secularize it to, you know, not scare people off. But what I found was that those were the things that were drawing me in. And so, you know, I had a tangential interest in Buddhism at the time, but it led me one way or another to start exploring more. And the next step for me, I remember, was reading Alan Watts' Way of Zen. And though he's, not a actual Dharma teacher, it was, I feel like it was kind of like a prerequisite to exploring actual Dharma books, because it introduced the concept of false dualities, which kind of blew my mind. And it showed me how, our minds growing up in a Western society, or at least for me, would see these concepts as very black and white, and that, usually, something, a concept from Buddhism, would mean something different to someone who grew up, in the country where it came from, so that I needed to kind of be more flexible with my thoughts on it. So I think this is kind of the common path of, a lot of people go from Alan Watts to Suzuki Roshi, and that, led me to Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And I was looking back to try and find, like, in my emails when I ordered these books, to see when I read them and stuff, and it was kind of interesting for me. But in 2018, I must have read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and that's when I realized, like, yeah, this is it. Like, this is for me. It felt like somebody explaining what I already believed but didn't realize, and putting it into words in a way that I, could never put into words. So I read that, and I was, started solo practice on my own, sitting zazen now that I had some instructions, but still very irregular. I'd, do it for a few days, I'd stop, I'd do it for a week, and I wouldn't do it for a month. But I kept reading Dharma books. I kept listening to a lot of Dharma talks on podcasts. I listened to a lot of Norman Fisher's talks. I listened to a lot of talks from this Rinzai school called No Rank. I would listen to them on runs, and I'd have all these, like, little kind of popcorn. I can't even call them insights, but maybe they just kept, like, pushing me down the path. So meanwhile, on the Catholic side of my life, I was becoming pretty disillusioned with the Catholic Church as a hierarchy. During this time, there's so much discrimination happening from the church. All the stories of child abuse came out over decades, and I think it pushed me away. But also my beliefs were shifting. And I remember going back to church with my family after not being there for a while, and hearing everybody chant what they call the Nicene Creed, which is essentially like the list of we believe, this, we believe this, we believe this. And it just sounded, I felt like I was hearing it as an outsider for the first time, as opposed to just, this is what I grew up with. But it was because, all these shifts were happening in my beliefs, and the idea of God as a separate entity just started loosening. And ideas of, like, well, God is just love, or the connection we all feel. God's not outside of me or any of us. It's just completely within. And that just kind of arose. I don't know where that came from. But I also had to, a big challenge for me at the time was, like, I was okay with that. I was okay with, letting go and being open to God being something bigger than I could conceptualize. But I was really grasping on to what heaven was and what that would mean for, the big question, life and death. I was grasping at, like, but I have to have a soul. I have to have a something that's all me. And the more I went down this Zen path, the kind of messier that all got, to the point where I started realizing that, my beliefs that I were holding very tightly, very concretely, it didn't align with that anymore. But I didn't know what it aligned with, and it just knocked the wind out of me. Dread and panic. I remember driving, I think, visiting my parents, driving around their, neighborhood running errands, and it just kind of hitting me. And I don't know how long it took. It could have been the same day. It could have been, a year later. But it kind of hit me that, there has to be a middle way between this Judeo-Christian idea of life and death and heaven and, afterlife, and kind of an atheist nothingness. And what really is kind of the best and biggest gift I think Zen gave me to that point and maybe ever is just something clicked where I realized I don't have to solve that problem. Like, it's not mine to solve because I can't. I don't know. And I started to see through all of our lovely Zen metaphors on, that use water to describe death and life, and something probably even bigger and I don't want to say better, but even more peaceful and encouraging than these old ideas I had. And I learned from that when Zen makes me uncomfortable or it makes me panic that I don't need to solve it, and I think of it as kind of a garden, and I just plant the seed in Zazen of that difficulty, and it always works itself out. It's incredible to me. It just takes time, and during that time, it's not my job to solve. So anyway, it's back to my timeline. We're getting kind of to the pandemic years, and during the pandemic, I started sitting more frequent. This became, more and more important to me. I bought my first Zafu and Zabaton set. But it still wasn't like regular sitting. I still always felt like it was something I was trying to fit in. And but I knew it was for me. I remember sometime, I was looking back, actually this is another thing I looked up. Apparently I signed up for the Valley Streams mailing list in 2021. And it took me like 3 years to come here. Part of that was the pandemic. Part of it, and the biggest part of it, was I felt like I had to have a serious practice to come here. I felt like I had to be, sitting every day. I didn't want to mess up when I came here. So I better, get good at this, or better get consistent before I, come and see what this is all about. Which is funny to me now because I had the cart before the horse, clearly. But I took an online introduction, one of the to meditations at that time. I think, Dorley, I think you probably taught it online, that many years ago. But what else? So coming out of the pandemic, I always was saying, I feel like I'm circling this Buddhist thing, this Zen thing, and dipping my toe in, pulling back, dipping my toe in, pulling back. I know I want to get serious about it, or I know I want to at least experience it more, but, life is happening. And meanwhile, I had been promoted in my job. So when I moved here to Sacramento, I found this organization that was looking for communication specialists, and they are a rare, they're a nonprofit that supports patients with rare autoimmune skin diseases. And I thought it was just kind of a passing job I'd do for a year or two until I found the next thing. I'm still there 11 years later, but I was over time promoted, and 4 years ago was asked to lead the organization. So things were a little bit busy during that time. But The other reason this is important, my work is, it's a small nonprofit. It's nothing fancy, but every 2 years, we kind of act fancy because it's international in nature. We host these international scientific symposiums, which are like these 200, 250 person conferences around the world, depending on what professor or what researcher wants to co-host with us. And the university gets involved, and so even though I work at this tiny nonprofit, I've gotten to travel to Germany a couple times, to Tokyo, to Greece, to Portugal, all these places that I would never likely have gotten to go to. And this is critical to me coming here because in the summer of 2024, I was on one of these trips. I was in Thessaloniki, Greece, hosting these experts in this field, pretending like I belong there because I'm not a scientist, and just doing my best. And I had also signed up because I had decided to take this Zen thing seriously. I had signed up to this through the New York Zen Center. They call it their commit to sit, because that's what I needed to do. I needed to commit to sit. And what it is, they call it, it's a 90-day program online, and they base it on the idea of a practice program, but obviously it's not a real practice program. But they pick a book and they pick a topic and they focus on it. And every day you'd get an email in the morning with a short quote from the book and a 2 to 3 minute mini Dharma talk, and then a longer Dharma talk on the weekends. And the whole point was just wherever you are in your practice, this is an opportunity to deepen it. The book for that commit to sit period was a book from Harada Roshi called Throw Yourself into the House of Buddha. So here I am thinking I've been dipping my toe in and out, testing the waters of Buddhism, but life's busy. And then getting all these messages of how you just have to throw yourself into the House of Buddha. Just do it. Just commit and go all the way fully in. And, I would skip some days. I would kind of do it. But it became more and more important. But then on this trip in Greece, I'm in this beautiful place. I fulfill all my responsibilities. The conference is going great. It's towards the end, and I had an extra day there to kind of sightsee. And the whole time I was having this deep anxiety attack. I have specific triggers, and they were being triggered. And, I also was incredibly jet lagged and exhausted from the travel and not having enough time to recover. But anyway, I'm sitting there, and, I get these emails, commit to sit. And so I just say, that's what I'm going to do. And so I sit in the morning, and then I go out in the afternoon, and this anxiety that would normally hang on for weeks when I felt like this, it felt like its back just broke, and it fell away. And it was because I started sitting, not trying to relieve the anxiety, but because I was just sitting. And I don't remember what insight I had at the moment. I don't remember why, but it was just like the thing you want to do when you see that in the movies, like kind of slaps them on the face, be like, look at where you are, go enjoy it. And that's what I did. And I had to travel to a different country after that for another mini conference, but I was just floating. I mean, I found a place in the airport. They had not a meditation room, but like a religious room. Like, I was committed by that point. And so I sat every morning, and, my hotel room, piling up pillows. And that's when it kind of just all changed for me. The anxiety still comes, is there this weekend, it was there last week, but it goes away quickly. Part of it is, work I've done, but a lot of it is the practice, even though that's not why I'm doing it. So that brings me to here, Valley Streams, and I know I need to wrap up. But fall of 24 is when I first came here, and that was my first Monday night. I remember being greeted by Dorley and Jim. I remember Oscar. I remember Sarah pulling me aside and saying, "Oh, glad you're here. Just, you know, if this helps you practice, great. If not, you'll find something else." And it was just so low pressure, which is what I needed because the forms were challenging to me. The bowing, the chanting was, the bowing was new to me. The chanting reminded me of what I had gotten away from in Catholicism, and it, you know, made me put my guard up. But I remembered, you know, the lesson I had learned about, you know, from Zen of just giving it time. So I was like, it's nothing to solve. I don't need to figure out if this is right. Maybe I'll be a casual Zen practitioner. Maybe I won't, but I just need to keep coming. So that's what I did. I kept showing up sporadically at first. Because we were a one-car family, and my wife worked some Monday nights, but we are a two-car family now. And it's funny. Pretty soon, I started these things that were maybe put up my guard. The bowing and chanting. It's like I fell in love with them pretty quickly, because I started seeing them, you know, for what they were, and not this idea of what I maybe thought they were. I remember the day that I went from, and this is going to sound silly, but I couldn't do full prostration bows because they just felt like they weren't for me, or that I couldn't commit that fully. And I remember one of our New Year's practice circles, meditating on what came up, and we, you know, made our scrolls and things, and what came up for me out of nowhere, I thought it'd be one thing, and it was just pride. And that's all I could think of was pride. And I had to let go of my pride. And that night, without thinking about it, I just ended up full prostration, because I realized it was about letting go of that for me. From there, a year ago, I was lucky enough to go to Tassajara for our Sangha week, which, you know, just further gave me such a deep appreciation for the forms of this practice, seeing them in practice day-to-day life, sitting in that zendo, which, you know, most of you know, just burned down and is so heartbreaking. But I've, you know, had some distinct moments there that I'm running out of time, so I won't get into, but it was such a deepening experience. And so now I'm sitting, you know, been sitting every day for a long time now, and it's not to relieve anxiety or anything else. It's just because I found out I'm a person who sits Zazen. I'm a member of the Racial and Social Justice Dharma group that Dora Lee and Chris Fortin lead. I meet with Jim to talk about practice. I'm sewing my rakasu to receive the precepts. And I'm just grateful to be here, to be a part of this Sangha, for how welcoming everyone has been. It's truly remarkable to me, and I value it beyond any way I could ever express in words. So it feels strange to kind of lay out my story like this, but it's made me realize that this path has always been my path, because the way is the way, and I just had to recognize it. So it's kind of like I've never been separate from it, even though we talk about finding, you know, taking your step on the path. This is my path, and there's no other way I could have gotten here. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
So much, Patrick, and I'm sure there are responses that people may want to offer back to you or ask a question.
Sure.
I think We have a little time for that. Pass this.
Patrick, thank you very much for your talk. I just have a brief comment. I was struck by your reaction to the forms when you first came here. And my wife is Catholic, and the first time she came here, she was like, "Looks very Catholic," you know, because everybody wears black, and you know, there's all of this stuff, and we were still using incense at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, thank you for being here. We appreciate your presence.
Talking to other Catholics, because there seem to be a lot of us who found our way here, it seems they either are comforted by the forms, that it's like, oh, this is right up my alley, or, you know, meet some friction. That's interesting.
Well, I grew up as an Episcopalian, which those in the know realize is Catholic light,
yeah.
Diet Catholic, I guess. Very, very similar. And ritualistic, ceremonial. And the first time I came, as the bowing and the chanting, I was just greatly relieved. There was one chant and it didn't last very long. Now, I can live with this. Well, and now I find myself on the Don Rio, leading the chants, and so it all comes full circle, I guess.
It does.
And I think, kind of like you, I just kind of realized I had always been a Buddhist. I just didn't realize it.
I kind of feel like it's just seeing something, and then that you can't unsee. You know.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for your talk, and thank you also for your vulnerability and talking about anxiety and things like that. And I really resonated with the experience you had with your newborn, because I had a similar experience with my son. It was more of a thing where I was just looking at him, and it was all of a sudden, it was like, you could just see, it's like all this input, right, just going through the air. I was just like, oh my God. And I had that same kind of response to having this child, that and all that responsibility and all that kind of thing. So I really appreciated all that. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Patrick. And I was especially taken by the sort of pivotal moments that you unpacked more deeply, that sort of dropped you down kind of into a deeper encounter with life and death, and just what that's like, you know, to have to open at that level and also not know so much. And, you know, that was part of what you know, awakened you, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to like be open beyond what you had ever been open to before. So,
thank you, Patrick. I was asking Patrick in the lobby before his talk if he wanted to be a rock and roll star. He was like, "Well," but you have a rock and roll story. You really do. It's a chase type. And I was wondering if you like Peter, Paul, and Mary songs.
Sure.
So we could do a Peter, Paul, and Mary song on the next performance. I also spent time in Thessaloniki. I was an exchange student there, so that was different. And I had a very similar feeling that you described when you spoke about the chanting. And so great to get to know you. Thank you.
Thank you.
How does music and writing fit in your life today?
They're still very important to me, but they happen less and less publicly. I never kind of gave up on those dreams, but I realized that those dreams were the dreams of somebody who didn't know how that world even worked, so they didn't even make sense. So I'm pretty content to continue to do those things on my own terms, and I'm working on songs now, and have some recording gear at home, and we'll get around to even releasing them some at some point, but it doesn't feel like a ticking clock. Which I think is a good place for it. So,
and how about your running?
I always go kind of up and down with it. I always feel like I should be doing it more than I am because of my past. So I probably run once or twice a week at this point. Mm-hmm. I was just told I need to increase it to lower my blood pressure, though. So that'll be my motivation.
Maybe have time for one more question or comment.
Anybody over there who hasn't had a turn?
So thank you very much for sharing. I feel like our story is so similar. It's just completely different setting and characters. But like I remember the last meeting I had with the Episcopal priest that I was working with at this church that I was pursuing, because I was really into it and doing the Bible study and stuff. And we had, I think it was Ash Wednesday, where it was the best day there, because it was just quiet and dark and nobody talked and there's no music and no sermon. And we just came and we just sat there the whole time. And I remember saying to him in my last meeting with him before I left, I said, of all the times I've been here, this was my favorite time. And no offense to you or anybody else, I felt closest to you guys when we weren't actually talking to each other. We were just sitting there and being there together. I felt more closeness to you and everything else. And he kind of just blinked and looked at me and he said, this may not be the right place for you, but I appreciate that. So I feel like I've all along my steps too, I feel like I was meant to be down this path, without even knowing it often, so it feels like it could fit too for me. So I'm grateful you're here. I'm grateful to be here with you.
I have a funny aside to that. I don't know if this is a national thing. Has anyone heard of the A&P grocery stores? Was that a thing out here? Okay, I didn't know if that was an East Coast thing. So, my grandmother, my mother's mom, used to call people A&P Catholics, because they would only show up when they would get something. Like it was a grocery store. Ash Wednesday for A and Palm Sunday for B. So that was always our family joke. Not reflecting on your story, just it reminded me of that. The A&Ps.